we should be clear what we mean by the term ego. And the funny thing about the term ego is we sort of take it for granted. We think, oh, it's just been in our language forever. This is actually a 20th century invention. Prior to the 20th century, we didn't use the term ego at all. And the reason we use it is because of Freud introducing this concept, and then it's sort of expanding in our linguistic repertoire. And it was actually Freud's translator who introduced the term ego in the way that we use it today. And now when we mean ego, ego has a lot of meanings, and some people have a strict Freudian idea of it. But when we typically understand ego, what we're talking about are these suite of psychological mechanisms that help us negotiate with other people. It's all the things that we do to ensure our rights and entitlements, to try to keep us from getting in trouble with other people's expectations. Now, these didn't start just with us, and they didn't even start with the 20th century. Animals have similar types of psychological mechanisms, particularly if they live in social groups.
Eric Oliver, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So you sent me a book, How to Know Yourself, The Art and Science of Discovering Who You Really Are. And I got to tell you, it touched on a lot of topics that I have spent much of my time contemplating over the years. So we definitely share curiosities.
Great to meet a fellow traveler.
You seem to articulate the ideas much better than I could. Words do good like you do. You're a professor at University of Chicago, correct? And it's written like someone that would be a professor at University of Chicago. It's great.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think I have a tiny bit left, but I've been chipping away at it this week, and I have really enjoyed it. And I guess I want to start off by asking you why you felt compelled or inspired to write such a book.
So the story of that goes back to when I was in my youth, and my high school English teacher wrote "Know Thyself" on the blackboard. And she assured us that in these two words was the crystallized wisdom of the ancient Greeks, and that if we wanted to have a meaningful, independent, and authentic life, we would need to know the self. And I took her words very seriously. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I had a bumpy adolescence. I was like, okay, this will be the ticket to happiness. And so that began a lifelong interest in understanding what was behind this experience of being. And that meant reading a lot of psychology and philosophy, eventually studying meditation and yoga, dabbling in psychedelics, going on long walks in nature. And as I was doing all those things, I was still not kind of finding that answer I was looking for. And then in 2003, I got a job here at the University of Chicago, and this is one of the world's great universities. And I thought, okay, if there's a place to look for these answers, this would be it. And one of the great things about being here is that they allow us to teach whatever we want. So I put together a class that reflected my eclectic interests in psychoanalysis and neuroscience and Buddhism and philosophy. And my wife suggested I call this class Stuff I'm Interested In. Wasn't quite sure, but I offered it and it was very successful. And then I realized, oh, this was a class about knowing the self. So I've been teaching that class ever since. And then a few years ago, I was meeting a lot of adults who were saying, oh, that class sounds so fascinating. Do you have a book to recommend? And I said, well, I have hundreds of books to recommend. And I thought, well, maybe here was an opportunity to do something useful, to be able to offer this really positive experience that I was providing for my students based on their feedback, and try to bring together all of this scattered wisdom across philosophy, psychology, the Eastern contemplative traditions, and see how they speak to each other and put them together in one volume. And most importantly, to try to provide people a way of expanding the vocabulary of their own lived experience. We normally come into the world just assuming that we're a certain way, and this is a certain way of understanding. And for those people who become curious, who want to challenge that, they begin exploring in different routes. And what I think a book like this can really offer people are some new perspectives on their own just way of being. And so that's really what I was aiming to provide.
Well, it comes through like that. You know, you pull from so many different, I guess, genres of thought and sciences, and it's put together really nicely. So I appreciate that you did that. Well, I mean, because it's in the title, How to Know Yourself. I mean, what's how, let's start with that definition. Like, how do you define the self?
Sure. And I think this is one of the big challenges when it comes to self-knowledge is that, you know, for example, there are hundreds and hundreds of books out there that purport to help us help ourselves. But none of them actually describe what the self is that they're trying to help. And to understand what the self is, I think we have to go down to what our deepest essence is. And this is where science can be very useful for us because what physics will tell us is that we, at our very, very core, are energy systems. We are collections of atoms and molecules that are perpetuating themselves in a certain configuration again and again and again in this arrangement of energy. And one of the interesting things about this is that everything in the universe, in some ways, is an energy system. But we and all other living things are kind of unique as energy systems because we are doing something distinctive. We are pushing back against entropy. And for those who don't know, entropy is the great energy degradation of the universe. It's the second law of thermodynamics. And what that means is that energy in our cosmos is going from a higher potential to a lower one. So if you go back to the beginning of the Big Bang, energy was in its highest potential. It was the potential for an entire universe. And over time, that energy is degrading. So our universe is making fewer and fewer stars and galaxies. At some point, it's going to stop making them altogether. And this is entropy. It's this sort of great degradation in the energy potential of the universe. Life as an energy system is doing something interesting. It's pushing back against that entropy. It's keeping itself going. It does this by drawing in what physicists call free energy. And in our case, we take in all the energy from the sun and we use it to sustain ourselves and we use it to keep this flame of life alight. And this is where the self comes in because the self are all of those processes that negotiate between this life force, this animating energy that's resisting entropy and reality. And so that's really what the self is. It's this way that this energy within us, this flame of life, is keeping itself going. That's probably the simplest way. Now, the interesting thing is it does this in a very, very complex way. You know, this started with a single-celled ancestor that lived several billion years ago. And then as that ancestor evolved, it elaborated on these self processes. It became multicellular. It developed perception. It developed sensation. It developed emotions. It became this kind of multicellular creature. At some point in time, we humans started speaking. So we developed language and symbols and culture as a way of self-expression. And then, of course, we live in groups. And so we also have the suite of ego mechanisms. And this is typically what we think of as ourselves, you know, my identity, my sense of status, rights, and entitlements. All of these things are part of the self, but the self goes, these are all processes and they go all the way down to our cellular core and up through our highest epiphanies. And these are all just ways that this energy system that's within us is pushing back against entropy.
Interesting. So you're calling the self a set of processes that are kind of fighting the good fight, the uphill battle against what energy naturally wants to do, which is essentially dissipate from like a higher order to a lower order. So we have to like organize stuff which requires energy to, you know, that we get, like you said, from the sun or through food or whatever, to fight the good fight, essentially,
Yes.
to exist and perceive something about what's going on relative to us in some way. I mean, that's, I guess, part of it. There's like a, I guess there's a sense of awareness that we are something. We are experiencing something.
Yes, and that's, you know, it's funny because we don't always connect this, but whenever you and I are doing anything, whether it's thinking a thought, snoring at night, you know, anything from sort of our highest epiphany to our most mundane activity, these are all parts of the self. They're all parts of these processes that are pushing back against entropy. Now, they might not be necessarily the most efficient way of pushing back against entropy or the most productive way of doing this, but they're all, and they're in some ways, they're expression of the same underlying impetus.
Interesting. You alluded to the fact that we created language somewhere along the way. And I think in the book, you refer to language as, I guess, like a pivotal point where it facilitated humans to like create another layer of the self or something to help us, you know, navigate and survive. It was interesting because it's something that, you know, when you look out, I mean, I spend a good amount of time in nature and you look out in the wild, you see these animals, and maybe there is some degree of language from species, you know, different species, but obviously nothing like what humans have created. And they seem to still find a way to, you know, keep going and keep populating. And but we took it to another level in some way. And it's, I guess, like a blessing and a curse in some way, the fact that we have been able to create language. Can you touch on some of the significance around that, I guess, stepping stone in our progress?
Sure. So most other animals or most other living things basically are genetically predetermined in their behavior. You know, they interact with their environment somewhat, but their range of options about how their self processes get organized is pretty much baked into their genes. And they may learn some things along the way, but they have a very limited way of orienting themselves, and they don't really have a mechanism of creating or fabricating any kind of new self processes for the most part. They really are honed in by nature. Once we developed language, that changed everything, because what language allows us to do is take our perceptions and make abstractions out of them and begin to play with them. Without language, for example, if you take chimpanzees, chimpanzees can do basic kind of rudimentary reasoning using sticks and stones and other objects, but they're very much limited in terms of what's in front of them.
Before we begin today's episode, I want to share something really special with you, something I've been pouring my heart into. If you've been feeling tired in a way that sleep doesn't fix, if you've noticed you're carrying tension all the time, or you're stuck in that cycle of pushing, achieving, caring for everyone else, and running on empty, I've created something just for you. It's a weekend retreat called The Deep Unwind, and I'll be guiding it in person at the beautiful Art of Living Retreat Center in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. This experience is for the helpers, the overthinkers, the high achievers, the sensitive souls, the ones who are strong for everyone else, but craving a safe place to finally put down the heavy weight of responsibility and let their shoulders relax. Together, we'll spend the weekend slowing down and gently unwinding the patterns that lead to burnout and self-criticism. Through somatic practices, guided hypnotherapy, nervous system healing, and myofascial release, you'll learn how to feel safe in your body again. You'll learn how to soften your inner critic, and you'll experience how to truly rest, not just collapse or detach, but to deeply restore. You'll leave feeling lighter, clearer, more grounded, and more connected to yourself than you've felt in a long time. And everyone who joins us will receive a myofascial release kit with my favorite tools that I personally use and teach with, plus a signed copy of my book so you can continue the work at home. If this sounds like exactly what your nervous system has been asking for, I'd love to meet you there. You can learn more and reserve your spot at themindfulmovement.com/retreat. I look forward to welcoming you to The Deep Unwind.
If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it, most of all, is that even though it could work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space.
Once we have words for things, I can begin to think about stick, stone, fire, even if those things aren't present. And I can begin to then imagine them configured in new and novel ways. And this allows this kind of reasoning process. And more importantly, I can begin to think about myself, because what language allows us to do is, oh, I have a concept of Eric, me. An animal has kind of a first person perspective of I. They're always kind of caught in this I perspective, but they don't really have the ability to reflect on themselves as a me. With language, we can now say, oh, I am an object. There's me, Eric. Here's this guy. He's a character. I can think about him. Is he a good person? Is he a bad person? Is he fulfilling some role? What will people think about him? I can begin to imagine him in all kinds of new ways. And once we begin to do this, we begin to then evaluate our own self-processes, and we develop morals and rules and laws that we have to follow. We develop expectations about who or what we should be. And no other species does this. You know, no other species creates statues of themselves or then judges themselves by how far they deviate from some standard of what, like, a good lion is supposed to be or a good zebra is supposed to be. And so even though other animals communicate in this way, they don't have the same kind of abstract symbolic qualities that our language does. And that was a huge change for our species. And on the one hand, it allowed us to develop all kinds of new technologies. I mean, we sit atop of the food chain. It's kind of remarkable how we dominate the planet. We live in more comfort and physical security than at any time in history. And this is all a product of our language. At the same time, it's also taking us away from what we might call our authentic self processes are, you know, which are biologically situated, what our DNA is programmed to be. And oftentimes this leads us to a lot of imbalances in our self processes. Carry around a lot of unproductive emotions. We get obsessed with a lot of unhelpful thought routines. I write in the book that it wasn't knowledge that cast us out of the Garden of Eden. It was language. And we now, you know, live removed from what our natural way of being is. And there's no real going back for us. We are stuck in this situation. And so a lot of what really self-knowledge is about, and trying this impetus for self-knowledge, is trying to in some ways correct this imbalance between what our natural, authentic animal self is, you know, designed to do, and what this linguistic, synthetic, plastic self that we've created in our culture and our language and our identities, what that thinks it needs to do.
Hmm. Have you ever watched the documentary Chimp Empire? I think it was on Netflix.
No, I haven't seen that.
It might push back on some of those ideas that were so unique relative to the animal world and some of those things.
Well, it's interesting, you know, because with studying chimpanzees in particular, or our closest ape cousins, there's a lot of contestation about how we interpret their behaviors. And I'll give you another example of this. You know, our two closest primate cousins are chimpanzees and bonobos. And chimpanzees are typically, when we look at their behavior, they tend to be very violent, female, status-oriented, highly political, scheming kinds of creatures. They basically resolve all issues of sex through violence and coercion. And when we were looking at bonobos, it looked like bonobos were just the opposite. Bonobos seem peaceable. They were matriarchal. They resolve all of their issues of conflict with sex. They're polymorphously perverse. They're just constantly humping each other all the time. And so, you know, you could say sort of chimps are from Mars and bonobos are from Venus. And there's an attempt to sort of read onto them. The fact of the matter is we have to be very careful when studying primate behavior, because we oftentimes, you know, as in all things, we see what we're looking for in them, and we end up projecting a lot of our own assumptions onto their behavior. And I mean, this is not to denote, chimpanzees have remarkably sophisticated and complex ways of interacting with each other. I mean, they are our closest ancestors. They're going to resemble us quite a bit. But they don't have language. We can't really ask them, well, you know, why did you fling your poo at us? It's you know, we have to make our own interpretations of their behaviors.
Aren't you looking at that as they don't have language, excuse me, as we know that we have language? Like, how do you know they are not communicating a lot more than what we can perceive?
Well, what we know is that animals have communication systems, and this is what biologists call animal communication systems. And some of these communication systems are incredibly sophisticated. If you look at how whales and dolphins communicate, if you look at prairie dog barks, for example, are remarkably variated. Even dances of bees in terms of communicating where pollen might be are kind of remarkably sophisticated. And while animals have, you know, this repertoire way of communicating, it's very, very different from language. And one of the key ways it's different is that animals are always bound to the moment. When they are communicating with each other, they're always communicating about what's right in front of them. And they're not communicating relative to some sort of abstract reference point. So it's kind of like when animals communicate, it's like car horns. They're honking, trying to change something in their environment. And the other animal is honking back, trying to change something back. So like, say, for example, a chimpanzee is trying to do a dominance display. It puffs up its chest. It shakes branches. It's just trying to change something around it. It's not really looking to generate shared meaning. Whereas when I say the word tree or fire, I'm referencing something that's not necessarily in front of us, but I'm looking for you and I to have a shared meaning in this. And this is one of the things I talk about in the book. What that process did, once we started speaking, it selected on this trait of docility. And that's how we domesticate all other species. We always, like other animals, we always select on this trait of docility. And we were the first domesticated species because we domesticated ourselves on this trait of docility and shared meaning around language. I think language really is what domesticated us. And because we had to sort of agree that, okay, this is the word for fire, and I'm going to call it fire, and you're going to call it fire, and we're going to sort of subsume ourselves to the discipline of this is fire. We're going to be obedient to it. And, you know, if there was some annoying guy in our troop who was like, no, we're going to call that chungum. And like, you know, we can't deal with that guy. he's just going to be annoying to us all the time. And so this is what I think is different. Like when we started speaking, we demanded obedience to a shared frame of reference. It wasn't simply just that we were just pushing out signals to the world anymore the way our animal cousins do.
Gotcha. Interesting. You mentioned, you talk a little bit about the ego in the book. Do you see that as something that also is like differentiates us from the rest of the animal kingdom? Like they wouldn't necessarily have an ego that is like driving that desire to, like you said, like puff up the chest and change the environment or something or get some kind of response?
So we should be clear what we mean by the term ego. And the funny thing about the term ego is we sort of take it for granted. We think, oh, it's just been in our language forever. This is actually a 20th century invention. Prior to the 20th century, we didn't use the term ego at all. The reason we use it is because of Freud introducing this concept, and then it's sort of expanding in our linguistic repertoire. And it was actually Freud's translator who introduced the term ego in the way that we use it today. And now when we mean ego has a lot of meanings, and some people have a strict Freudian idea of it. But when we typically understand ego, what we're talking about are these suite of psychological mechanisms that help us negotiate with other people. It's all the things that we do to ensure our rights and entitlements to try to keep us from getting in trouble with other people's expectations. Now, these didn't start just with us, and they didn't even start with the 20th century. Animals have similar types of psychological mechanisms, particularly if they live in social groups. And for example, like, let's go back to chimpanzees. Chimpanzees have an ego, and what that ego is it marks them in their status hierarchy. So like most animals that are social live in status hierarchies in some ways. They're alphas, and then they're varying levels of beta. And their egos are basically always where they are in the moment in the status hierarchy. So it's, you could see it. I can see this with my dog, for example. My dog does these submission displays to me because, you know, I'm alpha and he's beta. And that's his ego. You know, it's him understand his relationship to me as one of kind of subservience and dominance. And I think our earliest human ancestors had that. That was their egos were always situated by their role in the troop, where they how much they had power over others, could they dominate others, or how much they had to subsume themselves to others, the will of others. Here's the interesting thing. Once we started developing language and cultures and laws and morals, that totally began to shift. And suddenly the social organization of our tribes was not situated around, you know, the alpha and looming over us. It was around laws and morals and norms. And in order to be a part of that, that got situated into our ego processes. And with that came identities. You know, I suddenly now, you know, now I had the ability to, my ego was wrapped up in my position in the troop. So I was a hunter or a gatherer. Okay, so that gave me certain privileges or certain rights or certain expectations. But then also I could become a good hunter or a bad gatherer. And I had those standards to evaluate myself by. And that became part of my ego as well, because I wanted other people in the troop or tribe to think of me as a good hunter, because that would give me more privileges. And then once we get morality, I want to be not just a good hunter or a good gatherer. I want to be a good person. I want to, you know, live up to the standards that we are now creating in this kind of linguistic stew. And so this is how the modern ego gets formulated. And the way that we did this, interestingly enough, is by taking a lot of our own emotional processes and turning them inwards. And this was, I think, Freud's great discovery, which was, in order to make sure that I meet the standards of my tribe, I perform a little bit of psychological jujitsu. I basically take all the aggression or other sort of kind of forceful emotions that I might direct towards others, and I begin to police myself, use them to police myself. And this is the origins of guilt and anxiety and resentment. All of these like negative emotions and neuroses that we carry around are part of these ego mechanisms. They're ways of making sure that we uphold ourselves relative to the standards of our group. And so that's really the modern ego has become, it's one of self-policing. It's no longer just bound to the moment and what can I get away with and what can I loom over? It's how do I make myself a good person relative to some sort of abstract moral norms?
That's interesting. So you're saying that the ego, emotions that we have about how we show up are generated from the ego and not the other way around?
Well, this is the interesting question. So Freud has this whole tripartite model of the psyche where he says, you know, we have this animal nature, this id, which is propelling us to kind of satisfy all our gross animalistic desires. There's an ego that's trying to negotiate between this id and the world, and the ego is too weak. So he says we develop this thing called the superego, which is this kind of semi-conscious suite of psychological mechanisms that keep the id in check. And this is what he says, you know, the function of guilt and anxiety and resentment are. It's what the superego generates for us. So that's one model of thinking about it. I think contemporary psychology has a more nuanced sort of view of this. But it's more along the lines of when we are raised and as we learn language when we are growing up, as we learn sort of what is acceptable and unacceptable behaviors, we internalize those things and we utilize emotional mechanisms to keep ourselves in check. So, you know, we grow up and, you know, we're taught to be a good boy or a good girl, and we want to learn, you know, we want to please our parents. So we try to do the things that we think will give us these emotional rewards. Similarly, we don't want to be bad because we don't want to get punished. And so if I, you know, if I eat that cookie, I might get punished for it. So suddenly, you know, I start having a lot of ambivalence here. Yes, I desire that cookie, but I'm also afraid of what eating that cookie will do to me. Or if I do eat that cookie, oh no, did I do something bad? And I start having guilt feelings. Or maybe I start getting resentful. It's like, why can't they let me eat that cookie? And so, and all of these things become kind of wrapped up in these ego processes.
You think none of those are inherent, like more foundational, that they emerge as a response or environment? Like, you don't think, do you think that someone that's unaffected by parents or hasn't had any influence environmentally, a 1-year-old or 2-year-old pushes over a 2-year-old and they cut themselves and are crying, like they can't learn some, there's not some inherent like guilt that 2-year-old could feel without language around it?
I don't think so. You don't see animals feeling guilty, you know.
I don't know.
How
would we know?
Yeah, well, you know, the problem is once again, it's, you know, interpreting ourselves. So I think about my dog who, like, he eats some goose poo. And I'm like, Aesop, that's gross. And then, you know, he looks like he's ashamed of it. But he's not ashamed. He's just doing a submission display. But it reads as a display. I mean, he'll just, you know, an hour later, we'll be happily munching on goose poop again. Like,
right. No remorse.
I just don't think he has that mechanism. And I think this is because they don't have language. They don't, you know, they may learn some lessons. They may be conditioned on certain kinds of behaviors. You know, they animals can do operant conditioning pretty well. But I don't think they have that same. If they have it, it's going to be a very rudimentary, simplistic version of kind of the emotions that we have. They're just not going to have the same kind of emotional sophistication. It's going to be just a cruder, more straightforward kind of expression. I think what they'll have is just ambivalence, you know, and that's how a lot of animals make decisions. So, you know, you think about the deer on your lawn and, you know, it's trying to decide whether or not it wants to eat your azaleas. And it's basically weighing like, oh, the temptation of the azaleas versus the fear of becoming venison, you know? So it's just, it's always in the moment. So it's just negotiating whatever emotions are there, kind of pulling it one way or another. I don't think the deer is contemplating, will I be a bad deer if I eat those azaleas?
Speaking of eating, you mentioned, I guess, a personal tough relationship you have with, I guess, balancing the ideas of free will and Häagen-Dazs ice cream. I mean, that seems to be something that also, I guess, separates us and is somehow part of those, as you say, like a network of like negotiations of some sort between like our reality and our sense of life force, whatever, you know, as you're describing the self at some level. Like where does the idea around free will fit into that equation, you think?
Well, I think this is where things get complicated for us because at one level, we want to believe that we are free, independent, autonomous beings. And part of wanting to know ourselves is utilizing that conceit to then expand and, you know, remake ourselves. So, I definitely think I'm in full command of myself, or I should be in full command of myself, or, you know, I think
those are two different things. You just said I am, and then you said I should be. Those are very two different.
Okay, sure enough. It depends on, like, you know, whose agenda I'm following, I guess I should say at that point. But I think within us, there is a common assumption or intuition that somehow or another, there's a part of me that stands independent and solitary and distinct that is in command of, or should be in command, because in those moments when I'm not in command, when I'm just chowing on Häagen-Dazs ice cream and I'm hating myself for it, you know, I should, and so that is the standard, I think, that we hold ourselves up to. But if you actually look at how our brains process information and how we go about just negotiating through the day, you quickly realize that what we assume to be free will is oftentimes much more a mental habit and much more routinized than we commonly know. And psychologists have an interesting way of describing this. They say that we have kind of two modes of system in our psychology. There's what they call system one thinking, which is typically very reflexive, habitual, fast, automatic. And that's the vast, vast majority of our thinking process and information processing. And because it's very efficient for us, we don't have to stop and contemplate, you know, should I turn the door handle to the right or the left? I just know I just turned to the right.
Is that like the subconscious mind? Is that like another way of...
Yeah, it's part of the subconscious mind. And most of the time, we're not even aware that we're doing this. It's, you know, it's like when someone throws you a ball and you just lift up your hands and catch it. You're not really thinking, oh, I need to lift my hands up right above my head. You know, you're just doing it. And that's the same way, like, you know, just looking around, you have organized routines by way to process all this information that's flooding your brain at every moment. However, sometimes, though, we're going to meet situations where we're either having some ambivalence, we're getting conflicting information, or we're getting novel information. Suddenly, we're walking in the woods and we hear a strange sound and we don't know where it's coming from. And that kind of uncertainty is dangerous for us as an animal. We are most efficient and most productive and most we have the most likelihood of survival if we can map our environment and make the best predictions from that map. And this is where system two kicks in. System two kicks in is slower, it's deliberative, it's more introspective. And so system two thinking is what we do when we're faced with a difficult dilemma, like we're faced with competing impulses. So like, oh, I'm really craving Haagen-Dazs ice cream, but I know that I shouldn't. Or I'm trying to make a decision like, you know, what should I buy my wife for her birthday? Or, you know, how can I figure out like my taxes, things like that. And system two thinking is slow. It's deliberative. It's purposeful. And we typically, when we're thinking about free will, what we're typically thinking about is system two thinking. It's that, you know, the thinker sitting there and contemplating things and making individual and autonomous choices. But here's the rub. Even our system two thinking, what we think of as free and independent, is not so unconstrained. It too is based on habits. And psychologists have a fancy word to describe this. They call these heuristics, which are these informational shortcuts that we rely on to make judgments. And even when we're deliberately contemplating and thinking about things, we are always relying on these heuristics and these shortcuts. And they're constantly warping and shaping our views of things. And I'll just give a simple example of how constrained even our deliberative thinking is. Most of our deliberative thinking relies on language. And so we are then bound when I'm contemplating, oh, what should I do next? I'm using words that I didn't invent. These were words that were bequested to me that I utilize to make these decisions, but I'm constrained by them. I'm constrained by this linguistic framework. So I might, if I don't have a word for something, I might not even understand that as a possible option for behavior or an action. And, you know, in some ways, this is what the book is about. It's, you know, it's self-knowledge is based upon, you know, how much a vocabulary we have of ourselves. And so the more an expanse of our vocabulary, the greater the set of tools that we have for exploring the world, and the greater autonomy that we have and freedom that we have to try to understand and make our way through it.
Hmm. That's interesting. I mean, the idea of system one, system two, I think that would be hard. That feels like very academic to me and very like we got to put a box around this idea or something. Because I would think that system one is inherently built in to system two, and however you emerge in the moment when you're in so-called system two, it can't not be affected by not just system one, but the cumulative momentum of every moment of your existence up until that point. Like, I guess I kind of feel like, I don't know if free will is real or not. I mean, sure, it seems like it is sometimes, but also it feels like you have no option but to do what you're about to do. And if I ask you what you're going to do 10 minutes from now, you'd have a hard time being able to answer that You could have all the, if you really had free will, you might be able to determine what thought is going to arrive next. But we clearly don't have the ability to anticipate our next thought that's going to emerge. I mean, I don't even know if anyone really understands where our thoughts and ideas come from anyway. But it seems like our life experience on some level is a series of moments, a collection of moments, and there's like a cumulative momentum that they bring, that they are driving into the next moment. Like, that's why when I hear people say like, oh, if I was so-and-so, I would do different. They shouldn't do that. If I was them, I would do this. And I'm like, bullshit. If you were them, you'd do the same fucking thing they're doing because you'd be them.
Yeah.
And you'd be shaped by every moment prior to that, which...
Well, I think what you're describing in the Eastern tradition is known as karma, which is what we are is the cumulative residue of all of our past actions. And so when, and this actually residue. Gets to the sort of heart of self-knowledge, because this is where transcendence comes in. Because if you think about, like, yes, you and I at this moment are definitely, you know, just marinating in the residue of all of our past actions and choices. And part of that is just how, when I learn language, and when you learn language, when I learn all my behaviors, when I learn my mental routines that I rely on, a huge chunk of those were learned and acquired. And so, you know, every time, and then, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, this is what karma is. And what, when we continually re-engage with these habitual reactions, so every time I mindlessly just reach for the Haagen-Dazs and I just start, you know, stuffing my face with ice cream without really thinking about it to satisfy whatever need I'm trying to meet with the ice cream, whether it's like some emotional longing or just desire to like distract myself with
maybe you're
yummy.
Just low in sugar, Eric, and you need ice cream. Yeah. Like, you were trying to fight back against entropy. And you got to make ATP.
Yeah, yeah.
Ice cream, Haagen-Dazs provides a lot of the substrate to make ATP.
Sure does. So, yeah, any number of reasons. And that's, you know, the question is when I continually re-engage in those things, am I doing something that's actually ultimately healthy for me over the long haul? Is this something that's reinforcing what might be inefficient or negative or counterproductive kinds of behaviors? Or is this something that is helping me rebalance my self processes to be kind of to live in a way that's more efficient, effervescent, and less burdened by all of the crap I carry around all the time? And this is really, you know, I think where we do get to exercise, I think, a sliver of free will is in this moment, because every moment provides us an opportunity. Am I going to, be mindful or not mindful? Am I going to try to be more aware of the range of options that are available to me, or I'm just going to, like, you know, just shove the food into my mouth? Am I actually going to really taste the food, or I'm just stuffing my gullet? Am I aware that, oh, in this moment, I am re-engaging in an old pattern? So, like, for example, when my wife and I are arguing with each other, I often find myself just getting triggered, and I'm just, you know, caught up in some sort of old cycle of, you know, resentment or whatever. And do I continue to engage in that and reinforce that? Or do I at that moment say, oh, I can step off of this train and I can, you know, I can step back and not be so caught up in that stew? And I think that's where we actually...
How is that moment not created from all the moments that you botched that idea according to your internal moral compass or whatever? And yeah, you found awareness, you've learned from those, so now you want to do it differently. You have self-awareness of what you did before. But the fact that you're deciding to do it differently this time, it's still like, you still make the assumption that, like, you had a choice to do that different in that moment. You can make the argument that you had no choice to do it any different. The time that you finally did it different, you might have still only been able to do it that way because of, like...
Well, I think this is Robert Sapolsky's argument. I don't know if you're familiar with his book, Determined.
I'm familiar with him. I've listened to like an interview of his. He seems super smart.
He is.
Yeah.
And this is his argument. He just says, you know, even when we think we're engaging in these moments of deliberation, this is all an illusion. It's all baked in, just kind of happening here. I'm not sure I'm going to quite go to that.
So he thinks we're marinating in residue all the time.
All the time. Yeah, it's just
I'm going to remember that. Marinate in residue. Yeah. It makes me want to change my clothes. Been marinating in all this residue.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that in a way, my pushback on that is that if you look at a lot of biological systems, complex biological systems like us, they're more probabilistic than deterministic. And that allows some behavioral flexibility from an evolutionary standpoint. So, take the example of the deer on the lawn. Maybe 60% of the time it's going to eat the azaleas and 40% of the time it's going to run away. And what determines whether or not it's eating the azaleas or running away may be some sort of biological roll of the dice. And similarly with me, am I, eating the Haagen-Dazs or am I, putting it away and, and saving it for another
biological
day?
You don't think it's an interpretation of some environmental stimulus that, whether internal or external?
But I even think that interpretation is probabilistic. Like, if you look at the way sort of consciousness gets constructed, consciousness is...
Okay.
Consciousness is...
Well, now we have a half hour to talk about that. Consciousness is constructed. Okay.
Well, yeah. We construct our consciousness, which is, if we think about what consciousness is the way we integrate all the information that's coming into us, prioritize that information in order to make a deliberate decision. That's really what consciousness is. It's this mechanism that allows us to make deliberate decisions and weigh competing sets of information coming in order to sort of make a choice. And consciousness is not fixed. It's fluid. And it has multiple indicators and influences upon it. And the relative, influence of one of those, or power of one of those influences relative to another one might determine on, where my energy level is at that, where I am in the time of day, where my blood sugar is.
You had your Haagen-Dazs yet?
Yeah, have I had my Haagen-Dazs or not? Exactly. So it's not like there's no one sort of fixed formula. It's always going to be highly contingent upon a lot of other factors that are happening.
Well, what makes can I stop you? Eric, what makes you so sure that consciousness is like emergent and not more foundational? Like, do you feel that before there was a point where we were humans but we weren't conscious, or we were an ape and we weren't conscious? Or,
well, see, I think consciousness is not something that we have; it's something that we do.
Before we begin today's episode, I want to share something really special with you. Something I've been pouring my heart into. If you've been feeling tired in a way that sleep doesn't fix, if you've noticed you're carrying tension all the time, or you're stuck in that cycle of pushing, achieving, caring for everyone else, and running on empty, I've created something just for you. It's a weekend retreat called The Deep Unwind, and I'll be guiding it in person at the beautiful Art of Living Retreat Center in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. This experience is for the helpers, the overthinkers, the high achievers, the sensitive souls, the ones who are strong for everyone else, but craving a safe place to finally put down the heavy weight of responsibility and let their shoulders relax. Together, we'll spend the weekend slowing down and gently unwinding the patterns that lead to burnout and self-criticism. Through somatic practices, guided hypnotherapy, nervous system healing, and myofascial release, you'll learn how to feel safe in your body again. You'll learn how to soften your inner critic, and you'll experience how to truly rest, not just collapse or detach, but to deeply restore. You'll leave feeling lighter, clearer, more grounded, and more connected to yourself than you've felt in a long time. And everyone who joins us will receive a myofascial release kit with my favorite tools that I personally use and teach with, plus a signed copy of my book so you can continue the work at home. If this sounds like exactly what your nervous system has been asking for, I'd love to meet you there. You can learn more and reserve your spot at themindfulmovement.com/retreat. I look forward to welcoming you to the deep unwind.
If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo Wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it, most of all, is that even though it can work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo Wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space.
Okay. Consciousness is an act that we perform. So I'm different from the panpsychics in this way that, you know, to assume that this, you know, some sort of experience of consciousness is intrinsic to matter or intrinsic to some living organism. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think what this experience that we have of consciousness is something that our brains are doing. And they're doing as a part of these self-processes, as a way of negotiating with reality here. And in this case, we have an introspective, self-aware form of expression of consciousness. And once again, I think consciousness is very much shaped by our language and our linguistic experience and this ability to imagine a self that's there, you know, and that has this particular introspective flavor. But I think, I argue in the book that I think almost every living thing performs consciousness. Perhaps, you know, even single-celled organisms are performing their own version of consciousness. It's a very, very crude, simplistic expression of consciousness. They don't have self-awareness in the way that we do, but they are making, even single-celled organisms are making decisions based on inputs coming into them and, you know, determining whether or not to sort of divide or undergo cell suicide. You could see this with bacteria. Sometimes, you know, they'll just move around and sometimes they'll tumble in a quick motion here. They perform a very, very rudimentary sort of decision matrix here. And it doesn't seem like consciousness because it's not like our consciousness, but they're just a very different kind of organism. We're a multicellular linguistic creature. So of course our consciousness is going to be much more
complicated. We have like 3 pounds of them living in and on us. Like,
yes, yes, yeah.
It could be their world and we're living in it. And
well, it's, yeah.
They could be our host.
Well, I guess this brings up another thing I talk about in the book, which is getting over ourselves here. And, you know, I think the Earth is still a microbial planet. You know, we are sort of Johnny come latelys to it. And more importantly, this conceit, when we think about, and this goes to consciousness, you know, I think we typically locate our sense of consciousness in this experience of being a singular, solitary being, this kind of intuitive feeling of soul that we carry around. And that's an illusion. Like, you know, there's nothing singular or solitary about us. We are, you know, not only are we carrying around this huge microbiome that's an intrinsic part of us, but even within our cells, you know, there are these mitochondria that have their own DNA. We are actually an amalgamation of two different species at the cellular level. Moreover, just as a social species, as a linguistic species, we are fundamentally socially connected. There's no there's no real I here. There's just we. And you can even think of it in a deeper way, which is like the life force started with a single-celled ancestor. And everything that's kind of evolved from it is just an elaboration of that same life force. And in some ways, we're not really that differentiated from all the other living things. I mean, we share 350 genes with every other living being on the planet. And we're all kind of cousins in the same underlying life force. And I sometimes find comfort in that. Like, it's like, oh, I don't need to be special. I'm not so alone. I'm really connected to this bigger web of life. But it also is a gut punch because it also means I don't matter very much. You know, I'm just one tiny little leaf on the tree, you know, not the tree itself.
Well, there's a lot of things that seem to like manifest some of those thoughts of connection. I mean, I know you alluded in the book to psychedelics, and that's one thing that stands out for people where, you know, they get a sense of like the idea that the fact that we are all connected kind of sets them at ease in some way, or you could be experienced through meditation or breath work or whatever. Or I know a lot of people within the world of religions experience, you know, like a connection with a bigger thing through prayer or whatever practice. But there's something there. Like, yeah, it could be like, oh, I'm meaningless or like I don't matter. But also it could mean like kind of the opposite. Like, oh, we're all connected and everything I do is affecting the whole. I don't know if you would consider the way you look at consciousness might be different than me, but like the collective consciousness, whatever this fabric is that seem to be, we are connected because whatever separation that we interpret is really just because we're viewing it through the sensory organs that we have developed, which don't show us the whole picture anyway. Like if, you know, we're kind of bound by this visible light spectrum where we see this ends here and this starts there. But if you look at it through some different tool that measures different types of information, it would look like a big quantum soup where there's no gaps. Well, I mean, everything is a big gap because everything's a lot more space and nothing that we think, but they're all touching each other. Essentially, it's all mush. And that, I mean, I find that to be comforting. I guess we could interpret that different ways, and you could use it to probably make your life better or worse. you could probably create a lot of unnecessary suffering out of thin air if you don't like that idea.
Yeah, it's which construct do you want to use towards what end?
Right.
And you know, I told a story in the book of, you know, I used to go backpacking by myself in the wilderness, and that's, you know, a very harrowing kind of experience. You feel very vulnerable and very exposed. And at night, I would feel especially, my mind would just start going in all kinds of crazy directions. And I remember thinking, oh, I could just reframe this experience of rather than all of these noises around me as being imminent threats, but as kind of being welcoming hellos. And then kind of once I reframed that, I was like, oh, I felt kind of cradled in this company. And it was a kind of a spiritual experience for me. I felt very much more interconnected and, you know, and at peace. And that's one way of interpreting it. You know, it was an illusion. I think even some of those creatures would happily have made a meal out of me given an opportunity. But, you know, we it depends on how it, everything is about our own subjective interpretation ultimately here too. So, and that's, you know, it's interesting. It goes back to the question of free will. To what extent do we want to embrace an interpretive scheme that is, you know, meeting some sort of emotional need? Do we want to develop an interpretive scheme that gets us to challenge or improve ourselves? You know, there's a whole way of interpreting and understanding our sort of lived experience. And to what extent we're able to sort of make autonomous choices in this is fascinating. But I think this is really what the task of transcendence is at some level, is to try to find and embrace those interpretive schemes that allow us to redress at least the imbalances that keep us living suboptimally. And I do think there's a more optimal way of existing than we commonly know.
Like, what do you mean?
Well, I'll give this an example through meditation. So I practice a form of meditation called Vipassana, and I go on these 10-day silent meditation retreats. And after several days of meditating, Your mind quiets down. In Vipassana, what you do is you scan the body up and down. That's the focal point of concentration. And after doing this for several days, this kind of more, you develop a greater sensitivity to your own lived being and your corporal body. And what becomes apparent is that beneath the layer of ordinary consciousness, there's an experience of being which is far more effervescent. That you know, if you get past your normal ways of interpreting your experience, you begin to realize that, say, an experience of comfort or joy is an experience of radiance and energy flow. An emotional challenge oftentimes manifests itself as blockage in this flow. And that's it's a much different way of understanding one's own being. It's a much more effervescent, luminescent way of being. And the more that you can be in that, just the richer your experience of being becomes. And the way I describe it is, you know, that experience when you get goosebumps, that kind of tingly feeling that you can get.
Familiar, yeah.
Yeah, that's, you're actually always experiencing that. It's just kind of so subtle, and it gets blocked out by all the distractions of our ordinary consciousness that we're not really aware of ourselves as experiencing that. And the more you can get in touch with that inner luminescence that's sort of latent and it's quiet, the much more radiant, peaceful, and expansive your own experience of being becomes.
So you mentioned you go on retreats to practice this, to cultivate this, sense of effervescence, I think you mentioned it. Do you have like a daily practice too? Or
So I try to meditate every day for about 15 or 20 minutes. And I also do yoga like 5 or 6 times a week in the morning. And what this is a way, because I'm not a religious person per se. I don't subscribe to a particular religious doctrine. But I do think there's this idea of spirituality, which, and what this is about, what I would call spiritual discipline. And for me, what spirituality is trying to make sense of this energy that comprises us. Because the funny thing about energy is that we can't really directly understand energy. It's actually an ineffable concept for us. We have, like, physics offers us a framework for describing the energies of the universe, but these are just placeholder concepts. They're just constructs that we have. So how do we make sense of this inner energy within us? And I think this is, in some ways, what spirituality is about, is a way of trying to apprehend the fundamental essence of the cosmos and ourselves within this. And I think what spiritual discipline is about doing is about opening up your consciousness to this inner luminescence. And, you know, there are various religions that have mechanisms for doing this.
Yeah, like, what's the difference there? I mean, when you say spirituality, it feels like you're saying it's a tool to try to understand the world better, or your place in it, or how to navigate it, or how to make sense of it. Like, wouldn't some people say that's kind of why religions exist? I mean, isn't it? What's the difference?
So I think this is the difference between spirituality and religion. I think religions, by the way, are ostensibly moral systems of rules and laws that help regulate a group. That's what they're really about, is getting everybody to sort of buy into the same set of rules about how we're going to negotiate ourselves as a group. So who gets to sleep with whom, who gets to eat what,
But aren't your morals shaped by your spiritual practice? Like, all the self-reflection and, oh, I shouldn't have said that to my wife that way earlier today, or like, I want to eat less Haagen-Dazs or whatever.
Well, I think how I would characterize spirituality as different from religion, or distinct from religion, is spirituality is about a way of characterizing or understanding the inner forces that exist within us and the universe writ large. And so religions offer a way of interpreting, or offer channels for the spirituality as part of them. And, you know, they have to account for that as part of this moral fabric that they're trying to weave us all into. And some of them actually have practices to cultivate this and understand this. So you could have, you know, in Eastern traditions, you could try to describe this as qi, you know, in the Chinese case, or as prana, for example, this energy. It's, or the ideas, you know, in the Hindu traditions of Brahman and Atman, you know, these kind of, you know, systems that are in the universe writ large. You know, in the Western traditions, we have an idea of the Holy Spirit that's out there, or soul. And these are ways of just, you know, similar to physics, they're just trying to characterize these energies that are within us, that animate us, that's, you know, part of our life force. These then get woven into the religious practices at some point. And some religions are much more spiritual than others. You know, some religions are just about follow the rules. And I think other religions, you know, like, for example, on Islam, I think like Sufism is a much more spiritual part of Islam, as expression of Islam, in terms of trying to get in touch with this energetic experience than, say, other forms of Islam might be. And you could say in the Christian tradition, there are, like the Franciscan order, I think might be an expression of a more spiritual, or even certain kinds of evangelical traditions tend to cultivate this kind of, the speaking in tongues, the experiencing the Holy Spirit, this kind of more of a spiritual practice there. I don't know if that answers your question or makes sense, but that's kind of how I would sort of differentiate.
Fair enough, for sure. Talked about free will and consciousness. I mean, I'm got a little bit left of your book, but I think I just touched on a part where you talked a little bit about, compiling all this stuff to get a sense of like what the purpose is. Like, do you have a sense of there is a life purpose, or that these ideas kind of facilitate us to individually manifest what we, you know, think our life purpose should be? Like, I'm definitely not making a clear question here. Let me rephrase this. What is the purpose of life to you?
What is the purpose of life? Yeah. Sure. And I get an answer for this from Aristotle, who's kind of smart about a lot of things. And Aristotle said that if you want to understand anything's purpose, you have to understand what its function is. So, you know, take the example of a hammer. The function of a hammer is to smash things. So
form is born out of function.
Yeah. And a purpose-driven hammer should be able to smash things, but smash things in as effective and efficient and excellent way as it can. And the Greeks were really into this idea of excellence. And the same thing applies to us. If we want to know what our purpose is, we have to understand our function. And I think our function goes back to us as our life force. And it's a life force that wants to perpetuate itself and keep itself going. But it needs to do this in the most kind of efficient and harmonious way that it can. And so really, to me, what our purpose is to optimize these self-processes. Now, it's weird to say self-optimization. It's a term you hear a lot, like in the brosphere, you know, and they think, oh, it means like, you know, taking health supplements and doing rhythmic breathing and all this stuff. And it sounds kind of shallow and narcissistic, but that's kind of a limited notion of self. If we think about ourself as not just our own psychological processes, but, you know, our social fabric is part of our self processes, our language, our culture, you know, what we want to do is, how do we ensure that this life force that's manifesting within us as a humanity, within our culture, within our collective society, is this operating in the most efficient and way that it can? And I think one of our challenges is that we are very, very inefficient beings. And, you know, we're inefficient emotionally. Most people I know carry around a lot of unproductive emotions all the time. I know I do. I carry around a lot of unhelpful anxieties or resentments. I carry around a lot of my thoughts. You know, I would say 95% of my thoughts don't help really very much.
Well,
and so, you know,
they might be helping you some way that you're not aware of.
I know this is a lot like when I'm doing yoga and I'm just, you know, like I'm worrying about like, okay, my next lecture, and this lecture going to be good. And I was like, is that thought helping anything? No. Most of the time, if I just look at the thought, I'm like, oh, this is just me spinning in a circle. I don't think it's offering some sort of productive way out. And maybe I need to spin in some circles to get to a productive spot. You know, I think your point is fair on that. But once again, I don't think I'm very efficient in my thinking in that way. And, you know, we can think about this as in terms of our diet, the way we construct our societies. So that's really what our purpose is to how to figure out ways that we can live in a way that's more efficient, more effervescent, more bright relative to this life force that animates us. And that's where I find our purpose.
On a broad scale, like on a societal or mass population, what does efficiency look like? Like that could be interpreted very differently. Like some people, they could think that these group of people are bad. The efficient way to living would be to kill them all as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that
that's
going to
be the next. That's the topic of the next book.
Okay.
Not killing everybody to make it efficient, but just trying to figure. I mean, that's what a better society. What are the criteria that we might want to say makes a better society? And the problem is coming up with that objective criteria. You know, for some people, they would say, "Oh, if everyone just follows my religious belief, that's the best way a society should be." Or you know, as you were alluding to, like the planet's overpopulated. If we could just eliminate, you know, 5/6 of the population, then the planet would heal itself and everything would be groovy. You know, there are very different conceptions about what makes the good society. And I think that's part of the challenge for us. And I sort of alluded to this in the book and I was like, this is a totally different book. And it's, you know, I'm not sure there's one solid answer to that. And that's what makes politics interesting is the sort of competing visions about what society should look like.
Yeah, the idea of determining what our function is really up for interpretation. Like when you think of something that's more, you know, non-living, if you think of a car and you think of its utility and like the function would be to, you know, carry you down the street, and it's a lot easier to assign value to what makes it efficient at carrying you down the street and keeping mm-hmm. you know, make sure you get from A to B. But, you know, there's a lot of context that we're kind of guessing around, that we all have like different beliefs of, you know, what the nature of things are, what the actual nature of reality is that we haven't really figured out. And then we're supposed to be able to know what our function is. And then we could assign what makes it, what's an efficient version of it. I mean, I do believe that the form does emerge out of the function. So I do think our form exists in a way to help us survive. I think the function of surviving is something that is more like stable in a way, like it's a more stable idea of like, well, that's obviously one of our functions because, you know, why would we be alive if our function wasn't to be alive?
Yeah, and you know, these are excellent points, and I think I'll crystallize this in something. So pain. Let's take about pain. So we might think that we want to minimize pain. I think that's how a lot of us go through life. That's a criteria for, you know, is something good or bad? Was it causing me pain? If it's causing me pain, I want to avoid it. And that's the sort of pain criteria. And at some level, you know, we might think, okay, we might use that because pain is information for us. The reason we experience pain is to let us know when something's going wrong. You know, don't walk on the broken leg. It hurts until it heals. But at the same time, pain is also inevitable. You know, a life without pain is anesthetized. So we don't necessarily want to, you know, we have to be careful in terms of how we're interpreting this signal about, you know, how we might want to behave. So, and then, you know, I think becomes the interesting question is it's not to either run away from the pain or avoid the pain, but to open ourselves up to listen to what pain is trying to tell us and try to come to a clear interpretation of what the pain signal is there to do. And I think that's the real challenge because
what do you think the signal of craving ice cream late at night is trying to tell you to do?
I think it could be a lot of different signals. I mean, it's the thing, like, you know,
I think you need more sugar, Eric. That's what I think.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, I get a lot of sugar.
Well, you think a lot and the brain uses a lot of sugar.
It sure does. But
you know, clearly think a lot.
I think too much.
Go ahead.
No, that's the key. Like, you know, it's in some ways, it may just be impossible to know. And so we just make the, every moment, we just make the best guess we can.
Through writing this book, I mean, it's obviously a collection of things like you've been learning for a long time. I got the sense of all from, you know, you pulled from Buddhism and your yoga practice and your meditation, and you've compiled this stuff. Do you feel like the act of writing this book, did you have any like profound, more like learning experience that brought you more deeper in any way, in any direction of what your, what you propose your function or your purpose is? Like, this make, did this make you a better Eric Oliver by writing this?
well, no, because I don't know if Eric Oliver was bad to begin with, or, you know, Eric Oliver needed to be better. Eric Oliver is just this marker, kind of this placeholder. Okay. I think what it's helped me do is foster a commitment to living more deliberatively, yet less bound by language. Weirdly enough, the irony of writing a book is like, can I go through the day where I'm not just so confined by the thoughts that are in my head, but can I just be in a moment where I'm more in my kind of sensory corporal self?
Well, that's interesting, because you shape these ideas that that language has this huge impact, and it's like it could bring you out of balance. It could be because you're like trapped within it. And you could be overanalyzing it, essentially, or overthinking, because you have these structures to work with. You have this toolkit of language. You know, you're thinking in the English language. So there's voices going on there.
Yeah. And that's part of it. I mean, I think there's this, ultimately, what I describe at the end of the book, there's this, I think, to live better, it's, on the one hand, we need to identify our imbalances. We need to identify our shit. It's very hard for us to do this on our own, because a lot of things that are problematic for us, at some level, we think are necessary for our survival. So we cling and we hang on to them. Our conceptions about how the world is, about who we are. Am I a good person? Am I a bad person? Should I be a better person? You know, all of these things. But we don't have like a foolproof system. Any system that we use to identify our imbalances and our problems is going to be problematic and flawed in some ways. We could use religion. So am I a sinful person? Well, religion has its own agenda. Religion isn't necessarily about helping me optimize myself. It's about, you know, keeping me tied to the group, I think, at some core level. I can use psychiatry. So I could go see, you know, a psychiatrist who would, you know, look for a diagnosis in the, you know, the DSM-5 and say, oh, you're having adjustment disorder. Here, take this pill. And that may solve some of my symptoms, but it's not necessarily getting to the heart of my problems. I could go to see a shrink and, you know, I can delve into all my life stories, and that might give me some awareness of some of these processes, but that's also problematic. So we don't have any one foolproof system for fixing ourselves. And ultimately, then, to me, it's about, okay, I try to use these tools to identify where I see imbalances, and then it's about trying to let go and let go of them as best I can. And this is where I think a spiritual practice comes into play. And for me, yoga is very metaphorical for this, because when I think about letting go, and I think when we intuitively think about letting go, it's like, oh, I just, you know, want to just kick back with the bong and the PlayStation, and, you know, it's absolving myself of responsibility. And that's not what letting go is. You know, letting go is a vigorous engagement with your crap. And it's about pushing back. And this is what yoga is about. You know, you stretch your hamstrings by engaging your quads. You really, it's about using certain things to leverage and push yourself. Meditation's the same way. It's about, okay, I'm going to, instead of immediately getting up the moment I have any kind of impulse to go check my phone or go to the fridge, it's saying, okay, what if I just stop and observe this a little bit more and see what unfolds? And that takes a lot of willful effort. And I think that's ultimately what it's about. It's about taking each moment as an opportunity to engage in this willful effort of letting go. And that's part of being deliberate and not so linguistic too.
Gotcha. Yeah. And there's a lot of tools to do that. And I guess we live in a fortunate time where we have access to a lot of tools. As long as you somehow get over the mysterious hump of the initial awareness that it's something you want to do, and shine a light on the idea that you want to take a look at yourself, then there are a lot of options out there, a lot of like modalities, yeah. You know, whether it
yeah.
be.
Yeah. And that's kind of what the purpose of the book was, is about trying to highlight, you know, here are some tools and here are some modalities that are out there.
Gotcha. Well, I appreciate you reaching out, Eric. And
oh, sure. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a great conversation.
How to Know Yourself, the Art and Science of Discovering Who You Really Are. Best way to find this would be?
Best way is a local bookseller. They're valuable parts of our communities. We need to support them.
Nice.
But it's available any other way too. But yeah.
Well, for the listeners, always grateful for your listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and I encourage you to check out the book. I enjoyed it. It was a pretty quick read for me. Every time you turned a new topic, it seemed to be a topic that I personally am also interested in. So I really enjoyed it. Didn't agree with like everything that you were saying, but I really enjoyed it. And it was like a culmination of a lot of stuff. I feel like we share a lot of different components along our paths individually, like where we pulled little gems from along the way, whether it be yoga or Buddhism or whatever. And so it really resonated with me. So yeah, check it out. If you have comments, please leave it. And is there anywhere else online that people could learn more about you? Do you have any social media presence or anything?
Sure. I have a website, jericoliver.com, that has a link to, say, for example, lectures that I've given on this my classes, some of my other writings. So that's probably the best place to start.
Well, great. Well, I really enjoyed connecting with you, Eric, and hopefully our paths cross again sometime.
Me too. Thanks so much.
Take care, everybody.